Good morning, Judge Henderson, and may it please the court. OSHA's key argument for a continuing violation here does not principally rest on the language of the statute of limitations. And it couldn't, because it's inconsistent with it. The statute of limitations requires an occurrence. The Supreme Court held in Morgan that an occurrence requires a happening, and there were no happenings here within the statute, period. Therefore, the Secretary's principal argument is that somehow a continuing violation is inferred from Section 8C1.
I hate to ask this because it sounds so 1960s, but what's a happening in your view?
Well, an incident, Your Honor, is another term.
Is a failure to do something a happening?
Only if there is a happening that triggers the duty, Your Honor. In other words, a duty triggering incident or fact.
Well, that's not what the statute says. The way you put it, a failure to do something could never be a happening because an occurrence, because the failure is not a happening.
No.
The happening may be a happening, but the failure to do something about the happening isn't a happening.
But
it's a non-happening.
Your Honor, there is the concept of a duty triggering fact in all the cases. For example, in Title VII cases, in lending cases before the Supreme Court, in bankruptcy cases before the Supreme Court. If you fail to do something at the time that the duty is triggered, then the other party can sue at that moment.
Well, the question is, what is the duty, right?
Well, so I'm sorry,
Your Honor. The question is, what is the duty? Not what is the happening, what is the duty?
Well,
which is another way of saying, what is the violation? Because the statute actually says, the occurrence of a violation, right?
That is correct, Your Honor, but the problem is that under the Supreme Court decision in Bay Area Laundry, you look to see when would be the first time that the plaintiff could sue. Under that decision, the first time that OSHA could have issued a citation was on the eighth day after the injury.
Okay, so that relies on the wording of this particular regulation, so I want to talk more generally just for a moment. Imagine OSHA had a regulation that says it's a violation not to have an accurate record at any time during the 5-year retention period. I appreciate they don't have that regulation, or at least they certainly don't have it expressly. But if they had a regulation that says it's a violation not to have a correct record at any moment during the 5 years.
I would suggest, Your Honors, that under TUSI,
Tusi's a criminal case in which there's no deference to the agency. Here we have a administrative law case in which Chevron requires deference.
Except, Your Honor, that under Tusi, there is an administrative law principle, which, by the way, is also reflected in Section 558 of the APA, which is that the agency has to have authority to, in effect, write a regulation that varies or really nullifies the statute of limitations. There's no agency that I'm aware of that has that authority.
Well, that,
certainly OSHA
that,
does
that's
not
like
have
saying, asking the question, does any agency have the authority to break the law? But that assumes that it's breaking the law. So that's where we have to start. But let's leave out 2C just for the moment. Imagine you had a regulation that said, and imagine it was a lawful regulation. That's the purpose of this hypothetical, okay? Well, I'll let you dispute that. But to begin with that question, and the regulation says it is a violation to not have at any time during 5 years an accurate record.
I would say that there are two problems with that stance by the agency. Number one, the statute of limitations still requires a duty-triggering occurrence.
That's not what it says. It says the occurrence of any violation. That doesn't say anything about duty. Doesn't say anything about happening. It says the occurrence of a violation.
Then in that case, Your Honor, you swallow up the statute because it will never begin to run. If you have a violation that turns on a failure and the failure never occurs, you swallow up the statute of limitations. The court's decision in Fitzgerald versus Siemens would never apply. The principle there would never apply. You'd swallow up the statute. The second problem is.
So let me ask this question. So the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, with which you're familiar. I know you're going to have an answer, but we're going to have a continuing back and forth on this. Says a convicted sex offender must register within 3 days of sentencing and update within 3 days of any change in residence. Okay? 7 years later, somebody who's raped 25 women and shot to death 25 young children and was sentenced and released has still not registered outside of statute of limitations.
I would say under SORNA, no, for a particular reason, Your Honor. Clear evidence of congressional intent, which all the courts under SORNA have found.
So it is possible, then. This is only a question of even the same words, then, could be interpreted as an intent to have a continuing violation.
I'm not sure if you'd be interpreting the words there, Your Honor, so much as relying on clear evidence from the legislative history. And I think that's exactly what the courts under SORNA have done. They have done exactly that.
So it is possible to use words similar to the ones in the regulation about 7 days here to have a continuing violation?
Only if you have clear evidence that that's the intent of Congress. Uh-huh. And you don't have that here.
So now we should talk about why we shouldn't defer to the agency's interpretation of the intent of Congress, which we would normally do under Chevron.
First of all, I don't think that Chevron even applies here.
Why is that?
Because the formality requirements of need are not met.
Yes, but you know, Martin versus Oshrick, the Supreme Court said you don't need regulations. You can satisfy those kind of requirements through adjudication.
And the Supreme Court has also clarified that its views, that need applies to all statutes. That is to say, there's a refinement.
You're telling me that Meade overruled Martin versus Oshrick?
I would say it refines it, Your Honor, in the following sense, if I may. That case did not deal with the degree of deference. It dealt with who gets the deference. The Supreme Court was not called upon to decide how much to give
Let me put it another way. We've said repeatedly in our own case law, which binds this panel, that in those situations where you have a bifurcated agency like this, and the agency, during adjudication, presents its interpretation, that requires Chevron deference. We've said that, I don't know, 3 months ago in an FAA case. We said it over and over again in Oshrick and Misha cases. So I think you have to start with the proposition that that's the law here, unless you can go to an en banc panel and have it reversed.
I don't think any of those panel decisions, Your Honor, consider the effect of Meade. There are formality requirements that the Supreme Court recently in the Mayo case made clear apply to all agencies.
So I just thought it'd be clear then you think our law is wrong.
I would say that the panels in those cases did not have Mayo. They did not consider Meade.
They certainly all had Meade.
No, I'm saying that they did not discuss me, Your Honor. Apparently, it wasn't briefed.
All right. So this, your argument here depends on us viewing those panel decisions as being wrong in light of Meade. I appreciate you're not saying that they're wrong because they didn't even think about Meade, which is the furthest thing from any administrative law guru's mind. But you would require, to succeed on this argument, we'd have to think we'd have to essentially say those cases were wrongly decided because they didn't consider Meade.
That there's a refinement that would cause a different result. Mm-hmm. I would not put this court in the position of saying that a previous panel decision was wrong.
No, but what you're saying is that a Supreme Court, they are inconsistent with the Supreme Court's opinion.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You're saying they're inconsistent with the Supreme Court's opinion.
I'm saying that had they been fully briefed with that issue before them, then they would have been inconsistent, but they weren't, Your Honor.
Assume you're wrong about that. No, put it another way. Assume that we don't. I'm not saying you are wrong. Just have to go on to the sort of the
even applying Chevron, Your Honor, if you take a look at the plain words of the statute. And by the way, the agency has never in their brief contested that if you have a duty-triggering occurrence, that starts the running of the statute of limitations. And frankly, Your Honor, they can't. I mean, there are thousands of duty-triggering occurrences under statutes all over the U.S. Code. And the agency or the police department can sue the moment that an obligation triggered by that duty triggering occurrence starts.
And how do you distinguish the unsafe conditions cases? Or do you not? Do you think that those...
Unsafe conditions cases, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Yes, so I take it OSHA also has a rule that says if you, pour toxic waste all over the ground, that's a violation, but if for not cleaning it up, and that violation continues for the entire length of the time during which you don't clean it up.
Well, you have an occurrence there.
What's the occurrence the second day? The original occurrence is it's dropped, or you put up a bad ladder, or you don't wipe up water from the floor, whatever.
You have the active exposure of employees to that poison, Your Honor, at every moment it is on the floor in a workplace.
Certainly not a new occurrence, is it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
It's not a new occurrence, is it?
I would say the ongoing active exposure, the ongoing active exposure of the employees in the workplace in the zone of danger of that poison, Your Honor, is an ongoing occurrence. And it's an ongoing occurrence at every moment. Here, we had a paper sitting in a file. The agency has never claimed that there is any ongoing effect of that on the employees in the workplace, and it would be preposterous to do so. You have just ink marks or lack of ink marks on a piece of paper. As to, and if I could, Your Honor, as to Section 8C1, which is the agency's principal argument here, actually, if you, all that says is each employer shall may keep and preserve such records as the secretary may prescribe by regulation. The agency never disputes that an employer cannot be cited for a violation of Section 8C1. Never disputes that. So therefore, the substantive duty is to comply with the regulations. Even if you could find a continuing violation on regulations, which I suggest under standard administrative law principles embodied in 2C, to be sure, a criminal case, but still it's there. It's a standard administrative law principle. Take a look at the regulations. There is not one word in them that conveys the duty that Your Honor was speaking of before. All of them impose highly and deliberately limited duties. For example, review the log at the end of the calendar year, quote, unquote. Amend the log if there is a, quote, newly discovered case, quote, unquote. And we'd had none here. There's not even an allegation of that. The duty to save the log means don't discard it. The agency has never shown how saving a piece of paper means, well, continuously re-examine it.
Okay, you need to wind up your argument. You're over your time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You need to wind up your argument. You're over your time.
I thank the court. I'll reserve our time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
All right, Ms. Phillips.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Heather Phillips, and I am here on behalf of the Secretary of Labor and OSHA in this matter. In essence, Volks is claiming that once 7 days elapse after a recordable illness or injury occurs, it no longer has any obligation to record that illness or injury. And as of January 1st of each year, according to Volks, it no longer has any obligation to examine and correct its 300 log and certify its annual summary for the preceding year. Volks is wrong, and its assertions are contrary to the purpose and language of the OSH Act and the Secretary's record-keeping regulations. And I'll note that these regulations are a cornerstone of the Act. They are critical to providing important safety and health information about the nation's workplaces. The information collected under the regulations is used by employees to assess the safety of their workplaces. It's used by employers to know what they need to pay attention to and what they need to correct. It's used by OSHA to assist in enforcement and for statistical purposes, and it's also used by the Bureau of Labor Statistics to analyze the health and safety of the nation's workplaces. All of these goals and uses are recognized in the OSH Act. Therefore, if these records are inaccurate or incomplete, they mislead employees, employers, OSHA, and the public. As Congress stated, Full and accurate information is a fundamental precondition for administration of an occupational safety and health program. Consequently, beginning with the eighth day after each injury and January 1st of each year, Volks had a continuing obligation to record illnesses and injuries and to examine, correct, and certify its 300 logs and annual summaries. And those obligations ran until the elapse of the five-year record.
If that's the rule, why doesn't the rule say that? So I take it he was cited for 0.29, Volks was cited for 0.29, 0.32. Those are the two? Are those the two regulations?
Correct. Yes, two violations under each of those provisions.
And in 0.29, B, the agency very helpfully answers the following question. What do I need to do to complete the report? And then it says, how quickly must each injury be reported? And it says it must be reported within 7 calendar days. But it doesn't say that you have to update. And for that, you look at 0.33, which says, do I have to update during the five-year period? And the answer is, you do have to update to include newly discovered recordable items. And nobody claims these are newly discovered. I take it your position is they knew them at the time, right?
I believe that's what Volk stipulated too, yes. That they do.
And then it says, do I have to update the annual summary? And it says, no, you're not required to update the annual summary, but you may do it if you wish. So what in there in those two regulations suggests, I think this is the point your opposing counsel ended with, which is all my questions are well and good, but the regulations don't actually say the hypothetical that I was proposing, which is that it's a violation not to have a correct record during the entire 5 years.
Your Honor, it is true that the regulations do not expressly say that. However, in determining what your obligations are under the regulations, you need to look at them as a whole. So look at the various different subparts and to understand what your regulations are. It's also important, of course, to look at what the statutory mandate
Well, the statutory mandate is authorizes the agency to issue regulations.
It actually requires the agency or mandates that the agency issue regulations requiring the employer to maintain accurate records.
Right, but the question is whether the agency has done that. You're not citing a violation of the statute, you're citing a violation of the regulations.
Yes.
Right.
And it is the Secretary's position, and it has been, of course, for some 30 years since these regulations were enacted, that they do that. And that is because you have a categorical requirement in both 1904.4a and in 1904.29 that each injury and illness must be recorded on a 301 or a 300 form.
Well, 4a is not one of the citations, right? They weren't cited for violating 4a.
True, but again,
and they weren't cited even for violating 33.
The failure to retain.
Right.
No, they were not. They were correct. They were cited for violations of 1904.29, B1, which was a failure to record the 300s, and that actually doesn't even have the 7-day requirement in there. But I think the point is that, as the Commission found, you have to read the regulations together to understand.
You think, I am confused, you think B1 doesn't require 7 days and only B3 does, and B3 isn't part of B1?
No, I'm sorry if that's what you're understanding.
It's all one thing, as you said.
What I said was that they were cited under B1.
Right, right.
Yes. In any event, the regulations impose a duty to record every injury or illness. Period. The only thing that circumscribes that duty, or it doesn't even circumscribe it, it puts an end to it, is the five-year record retention period. So if that weren't in there, frankly, under the regulations, you'd have to keep a record of every injury or illness that occurred. I mean, for example, you see other situations where that arises, where there is a continuing duty that doesn't have an endpoint. If an employer is required to train its employees before they're exposed to fall hazards, for example, and that employee has been working for a year up on aerial lifts and they've never been trained. Well, under Volk's theory, because a year has elapsed since that violation first occurred, even though it's continuing, the employer could never be cited for that violation because it's been a year. So there are many instances, as I think Your Honor pointed out, where there are continuing violations under the regulations and standard. And back to your question.
There are many circumstances where there are continuing violations, and I thought I understood counsel to say that continuing violations would be continuing violations. In other words, if there's a continued exposure of an employee to a hazardous situation, that would be a continuing violation. But that seems to me different than a regulation requiring records to be kept.
Actually, Your Honor, I would disagree because here you do have employee exposure to a hazard or to the condition, I'm sorry. And here the condition is inaccurate records. So if you're an employee who works at Volk's Prairieville facility, you'd like to know how hazardous your work site is. And here, I mean, this case is a poster child for an example of inaccurate and misleading records. They've got 67 injuries that weren't recorded on 301s. They've got 102 instances of injuries that weren't recorded on the 300 log. So if you, the employee, go in and think, well, what do I need to be worried about at this job? You're not going to get an accurate picture. So you are being exposed to the violation.
Is there anything in the record that these things are open to the employees or that they're told that they're supposed to review these?
They're not told that they're supposed to review them.
Do they even know they exist?
Whether these employees, I would assume they do because usually union representatives know that, and there are regulations that allow for employee access to the records. In addition, the annual summaries are required to be posted every year, so that's also another way.
How about if you fail, if the reg was you've got to train the new employee within 2 weeks and that's not done, and you all wait for 5 years before you cite, what would your position be? That's continuing.
Absolutely. It would be the same sort of situation. The 2 year point, I'm sorry, the 2 week point would mark the beginning of your violation, the beginning of the violation. And it would make absolutely no sense that the employer, for example, if you had to train your employee 2 weeks before starting the job in asbestos removal and the employer doesn't do it, there's no end to that duty to train. It can't be that an employee is now left without any protection. That's simply not, that would undermine the purpose of the OSHA Act, which is to ensure so far as possible the health place of the nation's workplaces.
What about opposing counsel's argument that if taken to the extreme, this would mean no statute of limitations, effectively mean no statute of limitations?
I assume Your Honor is referring to the regulations that he cites that have 30-year record retention.
Well, forgetting about those, but if we were to accept your position, you could write a regulation that says, I don't know, instead of a 5-year retention, you just always have to retain the records. There would be no statute of limitations. Effectively, it would mean no statute of limitations. Is that right?
Of course, I would disagree that it's changing the statute of limitations, right? That is in the statute.
No, but effectively, there would be no, leave aside this word statute, effectively, there would be no limitations on ability to sue. Is that right?
I think you have to look at 8C, which is the statutory provision that grants the Secretary the authority to issue these regulations. And if you look at that provision, it's very broad. In fact, the only restriction, it requires the Secretary.
Answer yes.
Pardon me.
Oh, the answer, yes.
Well, ultimately, yes, but I wanted to explain a little further.
You can say yes and then explain.
Yes, but for very good reasons in the statute. The Secretary has been given very broad authority to issue the regulations that it thinks are necessary for the various objectives. So there are some record retention requirements in the exposure areas to hazardous chemicals. And the reasoning behind that is my understanding, without having looked at the very specific issues that were raised prior to issuing the regulation, but you need a very long period to determine the exposure and the effects. And obviously that underwent vetting. Usually the rules are issued after all the stakeholders weigh in,
so
various periods.
Your explanation, you would say the way to attack that is to argue that it's arbitrary and capricious.
Absolutely.
Rather than to argue a violation of this statutory provision.
Correct, yes. And that would be subject to that challenge. But again, Congress has delegated great authority to the Secretary in administering the statute and relies on her expertise in setting and evaluating the various hazards.
Do you think you could have cited them for a violation of 33, the failure to retain a record they didn't make?
Yes, because they were required to make the record, and consequently you can't escape the liability for failing to retain it simply by never doing it at all.
Okay. Thank you. Does Mr. Sapper have any time left? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the very final point of counsel that is inconsistent with the Supreme Court observation on that exact same point, you cannot be accused of violating a statute that requires retention if there's no record to retain in the first place. It is in our briefs, Your Honors. I don't remember the exact name right now.
As long as we're at the Supreme Court, this time without even the miracle of Westlaw, I've come up with Martin versus Oshrick. And you said it does not address the question of deference to the Secretary's litigating position, as compared to regulations. But in fact, the court says, we are unpersuaded by the contention that the Secretary's interpretation of regulations will necessarily appear in forms undeserving of judicial deference. Under these circumstances in which the agency litigates, the Secretary's litigating position before the Commission is as much an exercise of delegated lawmaking powers as is the Secretary's promulgation of a workplace health and safety standard.
Yes, Your Honor.
So is your position that Meade has overruled Martin?
Has refined it. The issue in Martin was...
You can't say it's refined it because Martin expressly says we're supposed to defer.
Yes, but it doesn't say what form of deference, how much, and in what circumstances. That issue was not before the Supreme Court in the Martin case. The only issue before the court there was whether...
It says the Secretary's litigating position.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. And it does not say how much deference and how that is influenced by the formality.
Well, it says it doesn't have to be a regulation, that its interpretation of regulations doesn't have to appear in the form of a regulation itself.
Correct, Your Honor. And still, the question as to how much deference you get if it's in that form was not litigated before the Supreme Court in the Martin case. The only question that was litigated there was who gets the deference, Oshrick or OSHA. That was the only issue. And they are harmonizable because Meade considered carefully, and it was briefed, when you give how much deference
was
to what form.
Was it a case in which the agency had litigating authority within the before an independent body? Was Meade a case like Martin, where the agency's litigating authority was at issue?
I believe Meade involved something even more formal than that, Your Honor. It was an interpretation bulletin, I believe, in Meade.
But it didn't involve litigating before an administrative law judge, right?
I just don't recall, Your Honor, off the top of my head. I believe there happened to be administrative proceedings there. And the Supreme Court held, well, you don't get Chevron deference if it's that informal a conveyance of your position.
Well, I'm asking this because it sounds like Meade also didn't address the question that you're talking about here, because Meade did not involve a board within an agency before whom the Secretary has to argue.
Well, it involves something even more formal than that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel for the Secretary pointed out that the duty here is categorical. That is another statute-swallowing argument. All statutes of limitation assume a violation of some categorical duty. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in violation in the first place.
What was your answer? I saw a little confab on this question. What was the answer on the failure to train hypothetical?
Actually, the confab, Your Honor, happened to be about the counsel.
Well, I'm not asking for your intercom. I thought you might have an answer to her hypothetical.
Honor, I was not confounded by that at all.
Right, so what's the answer?
A failure to train involves an employee who is actively working in the workplace. He's there, he's operating a machine, she's being exposed to chemicals. A failure to train means that that employee is going to be, I'll say, poisoned or killed or fall. there is an active employee involvement involving the subject of the failure to train.
So you agree then that the failure to train violation is continuing?
Yes, because there is active ongoing occurrence. The employee is on a scaffold. The employee is exposed to a poison. That is not this case at all.
Well, what if it's the way she described the rule is you have to be trained before you do something dangerous. And imagine that they come in during a time when the employee is on vacation, not doing anything dangerous and hasn't yet done anything dangerous and isn't planned to do did something dangerous before, but is not about to do something dangerous again. So on day one, there's no training. On day two, they climb a scaffold. On day three, they're on vacation. Is day three still a violation of train, or is the only violation of train day one, or ended by day two, meaning the day in which they're on scaffold?
At the end of the second day only, Your Honor.
It's the only. So
yes,
even if sometime in the future, the employee will again be in a dangerous situation, the violation only occurs when they're actually on the scaffold, or what?
Yes, of course. There's actually case law on that. If they're not working, or if they're going to work, if it's merely a future violation, it's not a violation. The standards kick in if you're going to work.
So your view is that the violation...
If you're working, Your Honor.
So the training violation is not actually... You said it was continuing. It's not actually continuing. It's more like a step function. It's only the day before the actual risk.
No, it's the day you set foot in the workplace, you'd better be trained. It's not before. That's not when the violation occurs.
So it is a continuing violation.
It's continuing for as long as you have your feet in the workplace exposed to the scaffold, the poison, the fall hazard, whatever. But if you're not in the workplace, there's no violation.
Okay.
And you can take a look at Section 4A of the statute on that, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel,
you need to wind up your argument. Could you
Finally, counsel said that the employer knew about the record-keeping violations. There is nothing in the record that says that. That is incorrect. The only thing that the record says is that the employer received information that a case is recordable. That can mean nothing more than getting a piece of paper in their mailbox, not recognizing what it imports for recordability. I thank the court.
Thank you.